Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We carry the largest in-stock selection of Hunter ceiling fans. They provide consistent comfort all year round and also help reduce energy costs. Right now, save big on Hunter ceiling fans when you shop at Menards. View our entire selection of Hunter ceiling fans today on Menards.com. Plus, our weekly flyer with plenty more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It continues to get more and more interesting in the trial of Karen Reed every single day. New testimony, easier swing, kind of along the line of, can there be reasonable doubt? Is there not reasonable doubt? And it's swinging back and forth quite a bit. In my opinion, it's been swinging the line of, there's at least manslaughter charges going on here, but to second degree, where are we at? Again, that seems to change almost all the time. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, joining us. We'll dive into a lot of different angles in this, but since we last talked, there's been a lot of witnesses on the stand, including a medical examiner, including the, which is also the person who did the autopsy on Karen Reed. The kids have testified, and several others. What to you has stood out in this last week as some of the most compelling testimony in this trial?
Yeah, as you're saying, Tony, you know, this thing swings back and forth. This is probably the most challenging case we've ever looked at together just because of the swing back and forth, both between the first trial and our focus on law enforcement and their incredible missteps on to this trial, which is everyone's doing a much better job, both defense and prosecution. This week, I'll tell you, the medical examiner's testimony was really compelling for me this week. She said a lot of things because, again, we got to remember that I think the most challenging thing that we sometimes have is thinking in terms of reasonable doubt. And that's what this defense is doing a really good job of this week. So I think it was a good week for defense on reasonable doubt, not that she didn't do it 100%, but there's reasonable doubt that she may not have. And so I think that's what the medical examiner really did a good job of for defense, is saying there's a possibility here. And again, that's all the jury needs, is reasonable doubt.
I agree. I think it's really, it feels very much like where are you leaning is how you're going to take some of her testimony. Because I can see how it went in some of the defense ways, but I can see some other bigger ways where it went actually in the prosecution's way. There was a point where it was being questioned of, and I don't have the exact verbiage in front of me, but is there a possibility, basically, that the injury to John's knee could have come from like a side swipe? That's, again, I'm saying that. I know it's not perfect exactly what was said in court, but that's the gist of it. And the answer was, could be. Now, the answer could be was there to some other things as well. Yep. But that's the first time we've had the medical examiner acknowledge that John's knee injury could possibly be, you know, from a sideswipe, which I also find interesting because Karen Reed in the documentary Body in the Snow also says, could I have sideswiped him? Could I have hit his knee or something? Could he be out there, you know, throwing up in the snow? Weird things to say when you saw him go into the house that you, why would you know he threw up? Why would you think you hit his knee specifically? And again, all of this, why, if you saw him going to the house, why would you even be wondering those sorts of things? That to me is where it gets to be very, very questionable in consciousness of guilt. The person themselves is saying this over and over and over in God knows how many different ways. The other day I grabbed every clip I could find of Karen Reed saying something rather questionable or something that pointed to possible consciousness of guilt. And it was like 20 some minutes long. Clip by clip by clip by clip by clip. There's just so much of it. And these are not big clips. They're like 10, 20, 30 seconds apiece. So there's a lot of times she said a lot of things that make people wonder, how do you know that? Why are you questioning this or that? But again, that's where reasonable doubt comes in. And at the end of the day, that is all that matters. Whether she is innocent of it or guilty of it, that's where you have the factually innocent part. Factually innocent meaning you can't quite 100% prove it in court that she did it. Even if there is a lot of evidence to it, there's still reasonable doubt. But we're getting closer and closer with more pieces. And as of this recording, I have not heard, I don't believe we know as of this moment, if a judge is going to be letting in the updated vehicle timestamp data. Right. And the timestamp data is not anything new. It's not changing the timestamp data. It is aligning it with John's phone. Because every device we have, whether it's this, whether it's this computer or the computer you're watching this on or the device you're having, guess what? We're all probably off by a couple seconds because that's just how the devices work. So they needed to find a way to sync that up. And they had not gotten into the vehicle data as in depth as they have until this trial. And what it looks like is that vehicle data is going to sync up, allegedly, basically to showing vehicle strike, and then the time John stops using his phone.
Yeah, that's going to be really the most compelling thing to look at in the coming couple days here. What was interesting, the statement you made to consciousness of guilt regarding Karen, you know, I really wonder whether that thought process is in her mind or was ever in her mind. I'm thinking more that she goes into self-preservation mode. And that for her, it's what we've seen throughout is controlling that narrative because she goes into self-preservation mode. So whether she think, I don't know if that thought of me being guilty really entered her mind one way or the other or still does, but it's more of the self-preservation actions she's taking, which looks like, you know, consciousness of guilt or something like that. So, and therein lies why it's so muddled and why it's hard to understand because her communication, the way she communicates, is always in self-preservation mode. And that's what I think the jury is going to be really thinking about, is that consciousness of guilt, or is it just some narcissist, you know, that's self-centered and trying to control a narrative?
Yeah, I mean, and I have my opinions on that, obviously, of just when we break down all of her behavior, it kind of, there's a pattern to it. It certainly goes along a path of a certain playbook that, I mean, she's playing perfectly. She'd be, you know, gold star. you answered all the questions correctly.
Very predictable.
And that's what leads me to, when you put it all into context, And if unfortunately you've had someone that seems to follow this sort of pattern of behavior in your life for any significant period of time, it's easier to see. You have more reps in it. I do. I have a lot of reps in it. And other people that I've seen online that have also been in similar circumstances or have had somebody with this type of personality in their life, they see it too. And fortunately, you don't necessarily, it doesn't stand out to you the way it does until you've lived it, until you've had those reps there. It's like when you have kids. You don't know what life is like until you actually have kids. And then you have them, and it's like, oh, holy shit, this is a completely different world I didn't even know of, I couldn't even comprehend of until I've been in it. Same with having someone like that in your life for a long period of time and being abused by them and not realizing it and all of that. It makes more sense. If you haven't been there, and I get, it's harder to see. I completely understand that. I mean, I have conversations, you know, with family about my own story, the people I've been with, and they have hard times understanding what I'm talking about sometimes because it's looked at in a very different context of not having lived through that or had that sort of experience. But when you look at all of this together, that's where it starts to look really shady. And you were talking about consciousness of guilt. Right. You brought consciousness of guilt up then. Consciousness of guilt and self-preservation mode. Self-preservation mode when you're 7 is kind of different than when you're 37, 47, 57, whatever it may be. It should be. Hopefully it is. But some people it's not. Some people socially and in relationship-wise, they get stunted sometimes in life for whatever reason that may be, whether it's abuse or a trauma or there's so many different ways. And what I find interesting about this and the behavior of Karen Reed is that it feels like a 7-year-old in an adult's body and how a 7-year-old would react to something like this happening. Stories flailing, just running away from the scene. Number one, that seems like a 7-year-old would do. And you know what? I remember freaking out in my 10-year-old self when I jumped off of the playground at recess one time and I nicked somebody's back with my foot and I felt so guilty and horrible. But did I stay there and face the consequences or fess up to it? No, I ran for my life and hoped nobody would catch me. But that's what you do when you're a child. And then you mature and you go, okay, I want to be accountable for this to a certain extent and for whatever I've done. Not everybody ever gets there. And so when I see this idea that, Karen seems to have this consciousness of guilt that she struck him, the vehicle's likely going to be showing that. She says it in 50 different ways. That seems like a very childish way to respond. But then you look at her relationship texts with Higgins and just the way that these things are communicating. It's very childish. It's very immature. And the attitude that she is portrayed in all of these documentaries, again, very self-centered, very immature, very just tone deaf to other people's feelings and emotions because it's all about me. That's a kid. And that's where the actions that she seems to portray very much fit a pattern.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. And when you throw alcohol to fuel the fire on there and lower all your filters that you might have tried to put into place to mitigate all those things in ourselves, because a lot of us, do that because we know how we need to behave in proper society and culture and things like that. But when alcohol is thrown in the fire, all our inhibitions and our filters and our filtering ability completely gets thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And if you have a pattern of behavior where all you do is continually do that, it gets, there's no regulation, in other words. And as we've seen with her, she thinks out loud. She acts out loud. She's extremely impulsive. And what you're seeing is you're seeing her at her core without a filter.
Yeah.
And so, and it's funny when you're saying about the kid on the playground, but haven't we also known the kids on the playground when something like that happens that are the ones that come over to help fix the boo-boo?
Sure.
And don't they, though, aren't those the ones that we gravitate to because we want them part of our lives?
Yeah. And you know what? Here's how silly that story is. I felt so much damn guilt about that for years. Years later, completely side story. I'm in a different city, many, many, many miles away, hundreds of miles away. And an intern of mine brought in her friend that was visiting for the weekend. Guess who it is? This girl who I have not seen since like fourth grade. it's her. And I was like, oh my God. And I said, I was about like 18, 19 at the time. And I'm like, you probably don't remember this, but I have to apologize because I felt horribly guilty about this for the last, you know, 12, 13 years since we were in fourth grade. But at recess one time, I did this. She's like, I don't remember that at all.
The universe gave you a do-over, Tony.
I know. And I was like,
what's interesting about that too.
Yeah.
Because one, that shows, okay, good. Tony's not a psychopath. He actually has a lot of empathy.
I was a scared kid. I didn't want to be in trouble. Yeah.
And the most important thing is that you have self-correcting behavior. We were talking about this before the show. You know, the most important thing that we do as a human being is we have self-correcting behavior, that we're teachable, that we learn, that we move forward, we move on. You know, with the documents that we're going to regard in life are self-correcting. We as human beings are self-correcting. But when we get so entrenched in our own confirmation biases that we cannot learn and move forward and take in new data and do analysis and self-reflect and be more mature tomorrow than we are today, that's a scary place to be.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's individuals out there that do not have self-correcting behaviors. And so they become even more predictable because past patterns of key behaviors become exactly the patterns they'll exhibit tomorrow.
Well, it's like it can go two ways when an event like that occurs, whether it be the Karen Reed case or me in fourth grade jumping off of the playground and accidentally, you know, hitting somebody.
Yeah, you never know where a conversation is going to go.
You know, exactly. Like, there's two roads you can go down. Either you can go, or there's really three. You can go back immediately and say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have run away, whatever. I didn't do that. I was in fourth grade. Right. Today, I would be very different. But you can run away and then just keep telling yourself, well, that person had it coming. They're mean anyhow. You build up some sort of BS in your mind.
The wound collecting victim mentality, that is probably the greatest predictor of people's behavior. Are you a problem solver that continually sees the world as glass half full that I'm going to keep filling up with a hose if it gets empty anyway? Or are you the wound collecting victim that thinks the world owes you, that they're out to get you, that the universe has it out for you?
Yeah.
Those are the ones that generally create a lot of chaos around them. And they also gravitate towards other people with the same mentality. So you have pockets of total chaos, which I'm not saying that all these people involved here were, but enough of them are.
Yeah.
So let's think about this. Again, boy, we're diving deep on psychoanalysis here, is that when you have a lot of pain because you see yourself as a victim, which is a lot of pain, there's trauma responses in there, what do you do? You typically medicate that pain with overindulgences and bad habits. You know, some people will use that for positive and they'll work out really much harder. Because again, what you're trying to do is you're trying to give yourself a better dopamine hit. And in some cases, as in this group's case, they overindulge. They drink to excess. And then even more stupid things happen, as in this case. And so,
That seems to be the hardest part with this case. I mean, or a lot of things in society right now, people seem to dig themselves very deep into one hole on one side. And then if new evidence presents itself that maybe is contradictory to what that belief is, they are so far gone into that, there's a lot of backtracking and a lot of stuff I'm going to have to admit to being wrong on if I'm going to accept this over here as the truth. So it's a hell of a lot easier to just kind of brush that off and just keep absorbing what's going to reconfirm your own biases, and then you get confirmation bias. And this is why we are where we are today.
Yes, and people don't do that. I mean, once you form an opinion of yourself, of the world, or things even this case, once you're dug in on that, you know, you will only see information that validates your own opinion of yourself and the case and others, because we do not like invalidating our own self-opinion. It's horrendous. You know, Robert Greene, again, we referenced it numerous times, you know, laws of human nature. It is extremely accurate when it comes to that. That's why even, you know, every time, you know, we cover a case and we cover elements of a case, and especially this one, when you see comments and you get feedback on this, this, and this, you know, constantly reassessing, you know, like you and I are constantly, I mean, even, you know, in between us talking about this, we're constantly going back and forth. Did you see this? Did you see this? What do you think about this? You know, because you're constantly doing our best. Again, we're flawed as human beings, but doing our best to not be in the way of our own confirmation biases. And I think so on this case, because like we said, on the first trial, you and I are leaning heavily on the other side because of law enforcement malfeasance, you know, a horrible investigation, which is still there.
And we're still, we've yet to hear a lot of the arguments yet in court.
And the challenge with that, though, is in the in-between time, she opened her mouth more, which kind of swayed you the other way.
Exactly.
So
when it's coming from the mouth of the very person being charged and there's so many bizarre things that really point to guilt, you can't ignore it. And because it's new data that came to light that we did not have in round one. And that's why it's good to be able to go back and forth and kind of go, okay, based on this, at the end of the day, is there going to be enough to convict her without a reasonable doubt? I don't know yet, because there still is a lot that's yet to be introduced. I think there will be certainly ways that you could look at it where there's reasonable doubt, and I think there's ways where you can't, but it just depends on how your prism works looking at this case. Let's talk about some of the red flags here someone is trying to handle this. I mean, there's two ways that you can, manage a situation or you can tell the truth. Sometimes there's a little bit of mix of both going on where I'm telling this part of the truth and I'm managing it this way, but I'm just maybe omitting this part over here. I'm not denying it, but I'm just omitting it. Or you just have flat out denial and I'm literally adding things in there that never really took place, right? I'd like to believe they took place. What do you think's going on here with this? The entire defense strategy hinges on Karen being set up, from a behavioral perspective. Are there inconsistencies in her reactions that suggest control over narrative rather than transparency?
Oh, it's definitely, and we've seen it throughout, trying to control the narrative. And every time what I'm seeing is every time there's a new idea or maybe this, or I could have done this or didn't do this. And then looks like there's a change of story. Obviously there's bad memories from alcohol and inebriation. I think that were part of it. There's things that she wants to believe, but also, she's playing to the media and the social networks more than I think than a typical defendant does. And I think, kind of like in politics, they'll put up these trial balloons to kind of see how this lands. Mm-hmm. And if it lands well, we'll double down on that. If it doesn't land well, we'll try something else. Again, that's just the tenor I get from it. And so the red flag for me, well, just stick to what is, mm-hmm. just be, again, let's go back to behaviors of trust. Behaviors that inspire people to trust you and the things that are coming out of your mouth are very, very simple as human beings. It's open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. And those are what's missing here. And then also part of that is consistency. Consistency saying the same thing the same way. And if not, now granted, muddled memories, a lot of times now passed even more. So that's going to have some inconsistency. And I know people are saying all these other people are inconsistent too. Good. Mm-hmm. I don't care. We're talking about Karen right now. Mm-hmm. But the other thing too is what we're looking for in consistency is tempo. The way she talks, the way she communicates, does she get emotional or non-emotional? Does she maintain an even keel when being questioned about specific things? Is she responding at the same method and tempo, intonation, tenor, verbalization as every other question that was non-controversial? So we're looking for lots of congruency. We're looking for open, honest communication, vulnerability being key here. In other words, she just keeps saying, I didn't, I'm perfect, which is not true for any human being on this planet.
Yeah.
So that's why, so imagine this. If she stuck to the maybe I could've's, mm-hmm. that is actually reasonable because she's, in those statements alone, she's saying, I'm open to the possibility this could have happened. I was completely oblivious to it if I did. In other words, I may have made a mistake. There may have been an accident I was oblivious to. And so that would be a consistent, reasonable thing to say when you're blottoed and you're legally drunk, during that evening. But since it's going back and forth and all over the place, and now she's not, so see what I mean? There's no consistency in the story. So saying I may have, could have, that is actually displaying a potential vulnerability that I could be wrong. I'm open to the idea I'm wrong. I'm not saying I am, but hey, anything's a possibility when it's been proven by, doing the BACs the next day that she is actually above the legal limit for alcohol in her system for driving a vehicle and probably remembering anything accurately.
And that's where so much of the problem comes in and where people read her very differently. Open and honest communication, it seems like at the beginning, she was there. I mean, she seemed to be throwing that out. Okay, you think this is a possibility? Because if you're to take the sphere of what the possibilities are, you were in a vehicle, you dropped him off, you have a broken taillight, you didn't see him go in the house, even though you're lying about that now, and he's dead. Precisely where you have said you were expecting to find him.
Right.
So there's a lot of open there. And the transparency then started to get a little eroded as the story started to kind of change a little bit. It was first, you know, I don't remember being there. And then, you know, look, I get it. Sometimes if you had too much to drink, there may be memories that aren't there. And then somebody says, oh, yeah, we were here. And like, oh, yeah, we were. And then you do get some memories back if you're kind of in a brownout.
Right.
And I can believe that she initially forgot that she was at the house. And then she was reminded of it. And then, okay, I don't know that that's necessarily a lie to throw people off. I think that that would be pretty impressive if she was at that moment in time conjuring all this up and planning her game. But I can see, oh, yeah, I did. I was there. But then we get to the point of, I saw him go in the house. Well, Karen, you just said in 50 different ways that you didn't, that you did not see him go in that house. And clearly, he's laying where you said you thought he would be. And you said he didn't look mortally wounded. So there's a lot there, Karen, that makes me think you're not being as transparent as you were at the very beginning. And then the vulnerability part, at the beginning, she was showing it. She was, and in some interviews still, you know, even to recent times, she does show it for a moment or two. Could I have done this? I was thinking this. But then the moment the attorney steps in and comes up with this theory from the creepy, bizarre man that shows up and says, look at the people in the house. Suddenly, her complete story changes. And it couldn't possibly be her, literally her words. I couldn't possibly have hit John, I believe is the exact quote. And all of these things that she's looking at when she's being open and honest and being vulnerable, none of that matters anymore. That's completely out of the context. That couldn't be at all. Why? Because this one person over here told me something I like better. And that sounds a hell of a lot better than me being really unsure over here of what actually took place. So I'm going to go over there because that benefits me more. And consistency. There's no consistency in any of this. It's constant. I'm going to tell this person this. I'm going to tell this person that. Her dad, according to her dad, came back in an interview early on and says, Dad, I think I struck something. And then the free Karen Reed folks go down the road of, she struck the car in the driveway. But when you look at the context of the interview, that's not what they're talking about at all. Context is so key to this. Yeah, it's easy to throw, well, she hit that vehicle. Well, there was a tap. And let's just look at physics here. Bumpers, they exist. So the bumper hits the other car first at 0.2 miles an hour or less, which just slightly moves a wheel. You have to go frame by frame to see it even happen. That's not an impact that's going to nail someone's taillight and take it out. It's just not. That is not a possibility in this scenario. What seems to be more of a possibility is the guy whose hair is stuck in the back of your taillight.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and fibers from the taillight, you know, on John himself, too, microfibers. And the DNA, that's what I mean.
But then you have a really sloppy investigation. And that's the problem. Had this investigation just been done on the up and up the whole damn time and people did their jobs and crossed their T's and dotted their I's, none of this would be going on. I mean, the fact, I think it's insane that in an investigation like this, they didn't test the blood in the cups. Why not test the, they took the time to try, and look, I'll give the investigators points on this because they took the time. They said, look, if we don't get this now, we're never going to get it because the snow is coming down. What do we got? What can we put this in? We don't have the evidence bags. What do we got? So they took the cups and did the best they could and put them in a paper bag and put them on the side. to protect them as much as they possibly could, assuming, hey, the lab should investigate this and look into it. They swabbed the cups. They did everything they could to take the DNA there and let the ice melt and all that, but then they never tested it. So that's where you start getting into the road of conspiracy. That's where you start getting into the road of reasonable doubt, because these things over here look odd. Does it negate all of this over here, all the evidence that shows that she very likely hit John O'Keefe? No, but it does then, it opens the door a little bit more. It's adding a little more space to the floor. And there's that much more space to the floor now that we didn't have at the beginning that then makes people go, whoa, I wonder what's going on over there. I didn't see that before. And that's where you get reasonable doubt.
That's why lawyers get paid the big bucks.
Yeah. And they can keep opening that door, because there's a lot of door to open here. They still got Proctor. They still got so many other things that were not done properly or just are bizarre as to why steps weren't taken, where reasonable doubt can very easily come into this.
You know, boy, I feel like I'm beating a drum on this one and a dead horse at the same time. And that is, I think alcohol and this particular group and this particular department and the people that responded played such a devastating effect on this case at multiple levels that's why we're where we are. You know, so all these things I think that the department should have done better. I mean, as I understand it, Proctor was released, he was fired, and I think it was not related to the case because of alcohol.
Technically, technically it was drinking on the job, but I think we all know really, you know, what the real catalyst was.
So anytime you see smoke, there's fire, you know, so I wonder how long that was going on for you, and you think he's the only one. So I think, remember, whenever you have bad decisions being made and a lot of, you know, with departments we've seen that were corrupt, you know, it's not because people are just born corrupt and they're corrupt people. There's something going on behind the scenes that's enabling their thought process to be lowered to stupid. And a lot of times I say 95% of the times of the cases I've seen, there's drugs or alcohol involved in individuals, organizations, or institutions that are undermining the thought process of these institutions, which erodes trust, which compromises investigations and forensics. And I mean, the whole system just gets completely obliterated because people's brains are broken along the way.
Yeah. And it just becomes the norm. And this is.
And especially when think about this too. So I think about this because I think about the call outs I've had. I mean, so I have a friend of mine. He was a senior executive in the FBI. And I was just at his house for his 60th birthday not too long ago. And for years and years, and he's a former Army guy, former helicopter pilot, and his kids have never, ever seen him drink. And so I remember at his retirement party, and I don't drink either, but in the Bureau, I did.
Sure.
And so at his retirement party, I remember one of his kids getting up and saying, "Dad, you know, when did you give up alcohol?" And he goes, "I never gave up alcohol. It's just because I was told the day I joined the Bureau that I always had to be available and on call, I just could never drink."
Sure.
And so think about the time of day, and I've been on callouts where we were told, you know, like, you know, a missing person, a missing kid, a homicide, you know, whatever these things, even though I work counterintelligence, if you're in a small office, you all get called out.
Sure.
You know, and if it's in the middle of a holiday, I mean, I've been called out on 4th of July. I've been called out on New Year's Eve, you know. So do you think all these people on the middle of a blizzard in the middle of the night were completely with it, even if they're called out? With the exception of, I'll give it to the EMTs and everyone that's actually sitting in the station house, you know, on standby, doing their job, you know, that actually is on duty. But people that are on call, that's where another vulnerability lies.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, it's people are human in all of this. And I think sometimes people forget that, where it's like, no, not nefarious, just human. And on both ends of this, completely. There's so many questions yet to be answered here, and there's still a lot of testimony to come. Some very critical pieces coming in the coming weeks. We'll see where all of this lands, because the show is not over yet.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed.
only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.